The Woodstock Film Festival will present the world premiere screening of the new documentary Parkland Rising, executive produced by Katie Couric and will.i.am at the upcoming 20th Anniversary Film Festival on October 4th. The documentary, directed by two-time Emmy Award winner Cheryl Horner McDonough, follows the high school students and families who became fierce leaders of the national movement for gun reform after the February 2018 shooting of 17 people at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High in Parkland, Florida. Katie Couric began her journalism career as an assistant at ABC. She went on to report for NBC, eventually becoming co-anchor of The Today Show and later sole anchor of the CBS Evening News, replacing Dan Rather. She now heads Katie Couric Media, her production company, which centers around scripted and non-scripted projects that are committed to creating smart, trustworthy, and relatable content that aims to tell the stories that she believes need to be brought to awareness. Again, she's the executive producer of the new documentary Parkland Rising, and we welcome Katie Couric to the roundtable this morning. Katie, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. Nice to talk to you.
A great pleasure to talk to you. How did you get involved in this particular project, which I guess begs the larger question of doing work in documentaries in general?
Well, you know, I've always been attracted to unpacking these big, difficult, thorny issues, social issues that I think sadly get short shrift in the media, current media landscape. And I started doing documentaries back in 2014, I believe, was my first one. It might have been even earlier, where I wanted to understand the obesity epidemic in this country. It's something I've been covering for 30 years, but it was getting worse and worse. So Fed Up was the first documentary I did. And then I did another documentary about gun violence called Under the Gun a couple of years later. I followed that with a documentary called Gender Revolution, trying to understand this new paradigm of gender identity and how our perception of gender has changed through the years. I did a six-hour documentary series for National Geographic, and I met Cheryl, who is the director of this current documentary, Parkland Rising, during the course of my Nat Geo work. And when Parkland happened, she said, I really want to do something about this. And I said, I'm happy to help and support this documentary in any way I can, because reducing gun violence is a major personal concern for me, having covered so many shootings in the course of my career. So I was really happy and appreciative to get involved with this current documentary, especially at this time in the country, because I think we're going through, I always say this, I thought it was going to happen at Sandy Hook, but I feel like attitudes are really changing. A lot of states have enacted laws, and I feel like we're at this really watershed moment when it comes to Americans caring deeply about the, you know, number of mass shootings and daily violence that access to guns is creating.
Let us talk for a moment about Parkland itself, because yes, it is another school shooting, but something different happened. And it's hard to see the work of these kids in the aftermath of Parkland and not be incredibly impressed by what they did and what they continue to do.
They are, I mean, if you find yourself bemoaning sort of the people who are going to be inheriting this country and the people who are going to be in leadership positions, or if, you know, you're doing what's fashionable and kind of dismissing millennials or Gen Zers, all you have to do is witness what these extraordinary young people have done in the wake of Parkland, not only the Parkland students themselves, but students all over the country. And you think, you know what, the country is going to be in great hands, and perhaps better hands than it currently is, to say the least. So I think a lot of this film does focus on their activism. Cheryl and her team followed these kids and their families for 9 months after this shooting occurred. And I think just seeing the trajectory of their activism and some of the things they were able to accomplish, and their eloquence and their ability, to handle the backlash against people who are fighting tooth and nail to not do anything about this issue is profoundly, moving, and I think leaves you with a feeling of great hope and optimism.
You use the term backlash, which is certainly appropriate. It is surprising, though. I mean, I think of when I was that age, that if I went out and I said something and then adults were really mean to me, I don't know how I would have reacted. But the fact that they not only were able to just come back with a vengeance, but expect the backlash and were just ready to go is really inspiring.
Well, I think these kids are anything but naive. You know, they're incredibly smart. These were kids who were exceptional students, you know, championship debaters, and they really know what they're talking about. And I think they went into this with their eyes wide open, and they're almost preternaturally mature for their ages. And I was just so impressed with not only their ability to handle it, but their parents' ability, you know, to deal with, especially in this day and age of, you know, quote unquote, cancel culture and almost a social media mob that descends on people who stick their necks out about any controversial issues or make, you know, any kind of public statement. The fact that they were able to manage it and tolerate it and deal with it is a real testimony, I think, to their commitment to this issue.
What role do you think a documentary, what role do you think a discussion, a further discussion, especially when we're looking at guns and gun legislation, what role can a documentary like this have in that discussion?
I think it can play such an important role. I think, you know, when you relive what happened to a quote unquote sort of average American high school, and you see what these kids were able to do, I think it's just extraordinary. First of all, I think it connects people on an emotional level. I think it inspires people because I think they often feel powerless in the face of such a huge, complicated issue. And I think it shows how a small group of people, like Margaret Mead says, can actually change the world. I think it connects the dots for people. I think oftentimes you get little blips of stories on your iPhone or on the news. And to actually go in depth to help people roll up their sleeves and really understand an issue, I think it gives them clarity. And I think it's just, helps add to the public discourse, which I now think is at a fevered pitch because of what happened in El Paso, what happened in Dayton, what happened in Gilroy. And it just brings into sharp focus how big a problem this is. And when you see these kids, they were just going to school, and you see their cell phone video of what happened, you cannot help but feel completely invested in this issue.
Let us talk about your coverage. As you said, you've been doing this a long time. You've covered a number of these shootings. What was the first one that you covered?
I think the first one that I remember vividly was Columbine, when I flew to Littleton, Colorado, and interviewed a boy who lost his sister, Rachel, Craig Scott, who lost his sister, Rachel, and then Michael Scholes, who lost his son, Isaiah. At 4 a.m. on an April morning, pitch dark skies with snow falling in the background. And it was such a almost spiritual experience to witness the raw pain of these two individuals brought together by this terrible, shocking, just life-shattering event. And, you know, I covered that story for many weeks following the shooting. And again and again and again, and Sandy Hook and Aurora. I mean, I've covered many, many both mass shootings and really the daily violence that comes from the proliferation of guns in this country. So it's something that is very personal to me, because when you get to know the victims of these crimes and you understand the collateral damage and the long-term impact, you can't help but say, this is insane. This is absolutely insane. And whatever I can do to contribute to the discussion and help motivate people, I'm happy to do. And now, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine who works with Gabby Giffords and Mark Kelly, and she said reducing gun violence is now sort of one of the top three issues that people care about, in addition to things like the economy. So it is definitely, I think, reached critical mass.
The idea of a journalist just by nature being cynical, I'm curious as to, in your coverage of this, of what point following Columbine did you just think to yourself, okay, this isn't a one-off, this is becoming part of our American life?
Well, I think every incident made me think that. And then when I did a documentary called Under the Gun, and we focused on the daily violence in Chicago, you know, I think that mass shootings get a lot of attention, and there have been so many this year, but deaths from gun violence is a daily, if not hourly, occurrence in some of these major American cities. So I couldn't understand how after Sandy Hook, nothing was getting done.
Right.
I could not fathom that Americans would not rise up and say, we have to stop this. We have to stop the carnage, the killing of innocent children, 6, 7 years old, who are going to school. I mean, it's just crazy. And I think I just saw a slow, steady drumroll of these incidents happening. And of course, this year, I think, is the worst year ever. So I think that, combined with the fact that there's a lot of corruption within the NRA, and I don't think they've become inured to it, but I think they're sick and tired of it. And they see someone like the Prime Minister of New Zealand taking action, and they think, why can't sensible gun laws, especially when you consider 74% of NRA members actually believe that there should be better gun laws on the books. You know, we're not talking about taking people's guns away or taking them from law-abiding citizens who keep them safely stored under lock and key in their homes, because there are a lot of incidents, as you know, I'm sure, where young children are killed inside the home.
Right.
But we're talking about just keeping guns out of the hands of people who should not have them. And to me, you know, I've used this comparison. I see a lot of people talking about, if you have to have a license to drive a car, why is it so easy to go and purchase a gun? It is crazy.
And of course, we see that from the recent headlines of the continued power of the National Rifle Association over the Senate, over the president. And this is an organization that, by all other standards, is struggling mightily, and yet still has power and still has money.
Yes, it does. But I think its power is eroding. And I think there's a confluence of things happening. For example, in 2004, when the assault weapons ban was supposed to be renewed, and George W. Bush said that he would sign it if it reached his desk, for some reason, it stalled in Congress. It wasn't considered a high priority. And now I think, sadly, tragically, because of these senseless deaths and these mass shootings happening so quickly after one another in succession, that, you know, people are starting to say this issue really matters. I mean, I was talking to a friend of mine. President Obama could have done a lot more when he had the House and the Senate when he was elected, but, you know, it just wasn't a priority back then. And I think because, as I mentioned, of recent events, for many people, both Democratic candidates for president and just the American electorate, this has now become a really important issue for them. And, you know, for a long time, NRA supporters and members have been single-issue voters. Well, there are a lot of other people who are now single-issue voters on the other side. I'm getting all fired up about this, I can tell, but
that's
it's
okay.
Just so frustrating.
It is frustrating, and I think it's a frustration that bleeds through, and it's hard not to feel frustrated at any given time when your phone buzzes or you look to the television or hear on the radio that yet another one of these horrible events has happened. And there is something that is, we're used to it now. And that is perhaps the scariest part of it.
I don't think we're used to it yet. You know, I worry about that, as I mentioned, yep. that people have become inured to these things. I really don't. I see the reaction. I always post the victims because I feel like these tragedies have to be humanized. And I tell the stories of these individuals on my Instagram feed because I want people to say, this is a person, this is a life, this life was snuffed out, this person had two little children, this person was picking up her daughter at the airport and never showed up, this person was married to his wife for 65 years. You know, all these stories, I think, and that's why a documentary, I think, can be so powerful, because you tell individual stories. You get to know people, you get to learn, and you can't help but empathize with them because you see what they're going through. And so I really believe that, if anything, people are more outraged by this than they have been. And I think people have been awoken from their complacency, and that they actually want to know, what can we do? You know, how can we help? And I think that's where we are right now as a country.
The news cycle over the last 2.5 years, Katie, of the Trump administration, for you, do you say, oh, God, I wish I were behind an anchor desk? Or do you say, oh, thank God I'm not behind an anchor desk?
I mean, sometimes I wish I were, but I also feel like I can use my platform and the trust that I've developed with people over the years to tackle some of the issues that I probably wouldn't be able to if I were behind an anchor desk. And having to keep up with this endless flow of news coming out of the White House and the most recent outrage. So, you know, I think we have plenty of people covering that on both sides. I think a lot of journalists are doing an incredible job doing that. But for me, I think I'm at the point in my career where I want to turn my lens on things that I think really matter and helping people get perspective. And I think, quite frankly, because he's sucking all the oxygen out of the news cycle, there isn't much time to help people understand and appreciate all these big, important issues that are really transforming us as a nation, whether it's white nationalism or gun violence, or I'm working on a documentary on plastic. I'm working on a documentary on loneliness and social isolation, and how the President Obama's Surgeon General considers it a national epidemic. And there's a minister of loneliness in Great Britain, you know, and how could this be in a time where we're ostensibly more connected than ever before, that we are so lonely? And so I think while I miss doing the breaking news, I also appreciate that I can do these deep dives into topics that I think really, really matter. And some of the breaking news stuff is just kind of ephemeral at a certain point.
Katie Couric, you're my hero. I thank you very much for spending time with us. The name of the documentary is Parkland Rising, and I thank you so much for being with us, and best of luck with the film and the future work as well.
Thank you so much. It's great to talk to you.
The premiere screening of Parkland Rising will take place at the Woodstock Playhouse on Friday, October 4th at 9 p.m., with an additional screening the following day. The 20th anniversary Woodstock Film Festival runs from October 2nd through the 6th. You can find out more at woodstockfilmfestival.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.